Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I've come to the United States straight out of a place called Wayanad in Kerala, a very rich district until 2 years ago, one of the richest districts in the state of Kerala, in which agriculture has collapsed, and there have been at least over 150 farmers' suicides since January last year. At the same time, in the urban metro of Delhi, about the time I left, and in fact a little before I left, was a celebration of an activity of a different kind. On the one hand, you had these farmers committing suicide in extreme distress. On the other hand, we were witnessing a phenomenon that is about 3 to 5 years old now. Theme weddings. A theme wedding is where you take about an acre or two of land and put up a replica of a great monument, maybe the Taj Mahal, maybe the Sistine Chapel, if it's a Bengali wedding, even Kargil as a theme, and you spend millions and millions of rupees to put up a structure which is going to last 12 hours and then be dismantled after the wedding so as to ensure you exclusivity for your theme. So this can cost millions of rupees, in fact, tens of millions of rupees, because I think the last one of the biggest was 3 crores. That's about 30 million rupees is spent in creating this theme wedding. So on the one hand, you had these farmers committing suicide in extreme distress. On the other, you had this unbelievable display of opulence and wealth, but we'll come back to that story. I'm coming in from Seattle, where I noticed that the tsunami still makes front page, and that's as good a starting point as any. It's right here on the front page, carries over. There's more than a page, full page of tsunami stories in this, and I think it's a good starting point for our discussion tonight. On inequality and the things you don't get to know from your media. Just let's take the tsunami. Now, all of us know that the tsunami struck on, the stories you don't get to know, even if they do appear minorly in the press somewhere, give you a very different picture of the world functioning around the tsunami. Now, every one of us knows that the tsunami struck on December 26th, devastated 11 nations. 200,000 human beings died, 160,000 of them in 5 countries. And we know about the outpouring of generosity, et cetera, et cetera. Here's something perhaps that most people don't know. Of the 11 nations devastated by the tsunami, only five, have anything approaching major stock exchanges. 5 countries of the 11 have major stock exchanges. These are India, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, and Sri Lanka. Here's the news. Within 72 hours of the tsunami striking, as it became clear that the damage was phenomenal, every one of these 5 stock exchanges reached their historic high. Every one of these stock exchanges, the sensitive index went through the roof. The more the misery, the better the stock exchange did. The biggest records were set by the Indonesian, by the Jakarta Stock Exchange, where the maximum number of people, in a country where the maximum number of people died. The Sensex, the sensitive index of the Bombay Stock Exchange, reached an all-time high by January 3rd, when it was absolutely clear that the tsunami had been devastating in its impact. The JSX of Indonesia crossed one historic high after another. Every day it reached a different level. The SETI, the SETI of Thailand, the stock exchange of Bangkok, was higher than at any point it had been between 1997 and 2003. The KLSE, the Kuala Lumpur Stock Exchange of Malaysia, reached its highest in 5 years. And the CSE, the all-share index of the Sri Lankan Stock Exchange, clocked in at about 16 points below its highest ever since it was founded. Now, if it had happened with one stock exchange, coincidence. All five, the worst five affected countries have the best performing stock exchanges. What conclusion do we draw from it? Well, one conclusion that you can draw from it, though paradoxically it doesn't apply in this case, one conclusion is generally true. The majority of those hit by the tsunami were trivial and meaningless to the stock markets. Yet, they were meaningful enough to send the stock markets through the roof. How did that happen and why? The people affected were mainly fisher folk, poor people, domestic servants, people crowded into poor quarters along the coast. So they don't, many of them have absolutely no participation in the stock markets. So to that extent, they're marginal and trivial to the functioning of markets. However, the stock markets of our time also represent the interests of those who make money out of grief. The sense that sent the markets soaring was the smell of reconstruction dollars coming in. So the greater the misery, the greater the dollars, the greater the dollars, the better the stock exchange did. No coincidences. You can play that for one stock exchange, not for the five stock exchanges of the five worst affected countries. One of the great successes of economists and economics in the last 20 years is that we've completely divorced how economies are doing from how people are doing. Economies can boom while people sink. And we've made stock markets central indicators of how economies and nations are doing. By that yardstick, the greater the misery of the people, the greater the misery of those hit by the tsunami, the better the stock markets did. And the better the stock markets did, the better the nation is doing, because it's a central indicator of how national economies are doing. So the more miserable the poor, the better the countries are doing. In fact, I think it's a perfect metaphor of what's really happening in the world. Consider that the same sensitive index of the Bombay Stock Exchange, the Sensex, in May 2004, at the moment of the greatest triumph of the Indian people, when an electorate of 600 million voters showed the world what democracy was about, going to the polls in orderly democratic fashion, and actually we know how to run elections, and some countries still do. And an electorate of 600 million people went out and against the predictions, the desires, the desperate desires of the Indian elite, the upper middle classes, every single opinion poll, exit poll, the intellectual elite, the pundits of the television channels, just annihilated the government they did not want. Just did it against all the predictions and against the majority of the editorials in the newspapers, which took for granted that the government was going to return to power. That was the greatest moment of triumph of the Indian people. What happened? The stock market collapsed to its worst position in many, many years. At the point when the Indian people scored their greatest triumph, the stock market collapsed. At a time of enormous misery of the poor, the stock market reached its historic high, crossing 6,600 on the sensitive index for the first time. That's why I call the Sensex the misery index. It operates in inverse proportion to the happiness of the greatest happiness of the greatest number. But the tsunami was also remarkable, right, for its outpouring of generosity. I'm sure the generosity was genuine, and it would be nice, as the United Nations says last week, if the money actually showed up, because less than a third of what was committed has actually shown up. In the case of the Bam earthquake in Iran, less than 2% of what was committed has actually shown up 2 years later. But yeah, I'm sure the generosity was deeply appreciated by all those affected fishermen I saw in the Nagapattinam coast who were wondering what to do with the large numbers of neckties that have been gifted to them and discarded heavy overcoats as well. So, you know, there's piles and piles of neckties along the place, which, you know, sent to them in thoughtful kindness. I'm sure it'll be appreciated even more when the money actually comes in. I was asked on the way here about the fact that The Indian government did not allow in foreign relief agencies. It's about the only time in 15 years I have found myself agreeing with the decision of the Indian government. The last time you had 12 major agencies functioning after the Gujarat earthquake, they collected millions and millions and millions of dollars because of their capacity to put... Oh, right now, tsunami commercials are still running on television from international non-profit agencies. 75 cents can save a child sort of stuff. It might save the non-profit in question, but beyond that, I have no idea what it would do. The audit report of those 12 agencies, which functioned after the Gujarat earthquake, shows that they did not succeed in spending more than 20 to 25% of the money they collected, but effectively blocked those resources from hundreds of smaller local organizations that would have been infinitely more effective. Second, much of the money that they did spend, the 20%, was spent on building specially constructed, heat-controlled, temperature-controlled, air-conditioned tents for the activists who came in while the victims of the earthquake froze in the Gujarat winter. And that was one of the reasons why they were not allowed in again, and I'm very glad they weren't allowed in. This is still not to deny the generosity of millions of individuals, nor to deny the extraordinary coverage of the media of the tsunami. However, in the same period, if you take the district that was worst affected by the tsunami in India, it's a district called Nagapattinam in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. Over there, the tsunami destroyed 30,300 houses at one blow. That was the worst affected district in the country. In the same period that the tsunami destroyed 30,300 houses in Nagapattinam, the government of Maharashtra destroyed 84,000 houses in a week or two in the metropolis of Mumbai with bulldozers, police squads, and extreme use of force. 84,000 houses, which is 2.5 times the number of homes that were destroyed in Nagapattinam, were destroyed in Mumbai. How much coverage did you see of that? Right? You didn't see much of that coverage, right? Not only, by the way, this was one of the most major violations of human rights in recent times. It is a violation of a United Nations resolution to which India was one of the earliest signatories, the 1993 United Nations resolution on terming forced evictions as a barbaric and gruesome violation of human rights. Yet, the demolitions, though unprecedented in their cruelty, people were not allowed to take their possessions out of the huts. There were hundreds and thousands of kids have lost their school certificates, their college certificates, their birth certificates, those who actually had them. A lot of the women lost all their household utensils. They were not allowed to take these out in the demolitions because they wanted to make sure that they didn't come back. Having destroyed this, the city's elites then demanded and have filed a petition that the poor people in the slums be stripped of their voting rights because they're very scared. The Indian poor have a nasty way of getting back at you through the ballot box. So they've actually filed a petition in the High Court saying that these poor people should be stripped of their voting rights. How much coverage did you see of all this? How much coverage did you see? In fact, you couldn't, because though the newspapers were forced to cover it, it was too big not to ignore. Many, many stories, very sensitive stories, were actually killed in the newsrooms of the major newspapers. Some of these stories how did I see the stories? That's another story. Some of these stories were interviews with bulldozer drivers who demolished the slums, with the policemen who gave protection to the demolition squads. The bulldozer drivers, some of them said, "We did it weeping in our hearts, for we too live in slums, and we know our turn will come." The police constables giving protection to the demolition also live in slums. And they did not take any pleasure in the actions that they were forced to undertake by the government of Maharashtra. The people doing the demolition were from the slums. Incidentally, a United Nations Habitat report of around late 2003 makes the assessment that by 2030, 25 years from now, fully 1/3 of all humanity will live in urban slums. 1/3. The largest number of those are going to be in India and Africa. None of this got covered. Even in covering the tsunami, this is the mindset of inequality. What happened? The poor have no rights. Even in the coverage of the tsunami, whatever was done for the tsunami victims was a result not of their rights, but of our generosity. You are going to get a new house, not because you're a citizen of a decent society, not because you're entitled to one, which you are under the directive principles of the Indian Constitution. You're not going to get a house because of that. You're going to get a house because I am sorry that half your family was washed away in the tsunami. It's not about your rights. It's about my generosity. We've reduced people to that. We've reduced the poor to the objects of our generosity and our sympathy. You build your own home, we'll demolish it. But we'll give you a new one. If we choose to, that is, if we feel sorry for you. How agonized we are over how people die, how untroubled we are by how they live. If you look at the Indian stock market, coming back to that central indicator of how economies are doing, the Confederation of Indian Industry, which has the most optimistic take on such figures, says that the total number of people having any kind of investments in the stock exchange constitute less than 1.15%. I repeat, 1.15% of India's 180 million plus households. 1.15% of households. That's the most optimistic figure of those participating in any kind of investments in the stock markets. Yet, as I told, when the stock market collapsed in May 2004, it collapsed for all of two days. The country's largest newspaper had a front page mimicking 9/11. Ground zero, said the headline. 2,340 billion rupees lost, notional money, which came back 2 days later, notionally. And it had an aircraft flying into the stock exchange building, and the tail of the aircraft had the communist hammer and sickle. Well, when the stock exchange collapsed for all of 48 hours, this was following what every political analyst across the spectrum says is India's second most historic election since its independence, 1977 after the emergency and 2004. The finance minister of the country abandoned the first day of parliament, did not attend the first day of the new historic parliament. He came rushing to Bombay to the stock market to dry the tears and hold the hands of distraught millionaires of Dalal Street. Well, you know, because 2 days later it was okay, but he stayed there 3 days to make sure that the market behaved. Then he went home. It was meanwhile, an election that was very largely fought in at least two states on the issue of farmers' suicides. It took another 149 suicides of farmers in the southern state of Andhra Pradesh before the Prime Minister condescended to visit the place. But a twitch in the Sensex had the finance minister jetting out to Mumbai. That is the difference of attention. That's the difference in the attention you get if you are poor or if you are rich. So it's all about our generosity and our feelings and whom we are feeling sorry for today or who we feel sorry for most of the time. If you start applying these measures to the various forms of generosity that you see, you'd get a very different picture from what you get through the tsunami coverage. One of my favorite forms of generosity is the drive to wipe out malaria in the third world. Some of you may have read about this, the planned distribution of millions of bed nets to protect people against malaria. Have you read about this or heard about this? It's a plan involving the WHO, the World Bank, and anyone else out to make a dollar. The fun part of this malaria nets thing is, by 1980, India had more or less successfully contained malaria. It was almost wiped out by the early 1980s. In the 1990s, we entered the brave new world of structural adjustment, of huge cuts in public services, privatization of medical services in a large way, soaring costs of medical attention. 21% of the Indian rural public no longer seek medical attention for their ailments. That's the latest figure we have, because they simply cannot afford it. Okay? Now, After all these cuts, malaria resurfaces with a vengeance in India and in neighboring countries. Having caused it to resurface in the first place, now generosity demands that we distribute bed nets, millions of bed nets, to people who don't have beds. Now, if you're living in a hut, you don't fix your bed net to the wall because you don't sleep close to the wall, because that's where the creepy crawlies reside, the scorpions and other stuff. You try sleeping a little away from the wall. I'm a rural reporter. I spent 270 days of every year for the last 12 years in the villages. And self-preservation causes you to figure out these sort of things about where you sleep and where you don't sleep. Okay? So first, we're giving these bed nets to people who don't have beds. At a cost of God knows how many millions of dollars, it's planned. Every time it's been attacked, they have withdrawn quietly, only to try and bring it back through the next government. Now, if anyone with half a brain knows that even if this nets, oh, by the way, you'll forgive the gendered language, it isn't mine, it's theirs. It says that these bed nets will protect you against malaria because the nets are impregnated with anti-mosquito repellent. Whatever that means. Now, anyone with half a brain knows that the malaria, anyone with, you know, we'll exempt the experts, right? We're talking about people. Anyone knows that the malaria mosquito is not most active when you sleep. It is most active at dawn and dusk when people are in the fields. Of course, you could make a bold new fashion statement by walking about in your net, but it might cramp your style. The whole thing is one unmitigated racket. This is the generosity. The generosity, you know, the charity that begins at home and stays there. Right? It has nothing to do with the eradication of malaria in these countries. Speaking of malaria, one of the astonishing things you can look at in the spectrum of inequality across the globe, both in the way, both in the terms of what's happening and in terms of how the media cover it, is what I call the globalization of communicable diseases. Anyone in the audience remember this word? SARS? Rings a bell?
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
You remember how SARS was perceived moving about like the Black Death, mowing down millions in its deadly wake? You know how many people actually died of SARS in India? Zero. SARS, zero. You can look at the World Health Organization's website on the subject. Total number of cases identified in India? 3. But from the coverage you got in the media, you'd think that SARS, you know, the subcontinent was in danger of its survival, right? For the way it was covered. 3 cases of SARS, 0 deaths from SARS. Why did SARS get so much attention? And by the way, I'm not saying SARS is not dangerous. You're going to get a hell of a lot more of SARS by other names and not in the not too distant future. Because we have globalized communicable diseases through the strategies of the last 10, 15 years, through the policies of the last 10, 15 years. However, it's important to look at why SARS or plague got, you know, in 94 we had a plague in India. Every aircraft going out of India was sprayed while going out, sprayed while being received at in airports in the West. The plague killed 53 people. SARS, worldwide, in its 100 days, according to the World Health Organization's website, in the 100 days of its existence in the first round, across the planet, SARS killed 879 human beings. That's about half the number of people who die of tuberculosis every day in India. But TB never gets the same kind of coverage because it kills the wrong people. SARS germs, plague germs, kill the beautiful people. So they get that kind of attention in the media, in the medical systems, in the government's policies. Plague germs, SARS germs, they are notorious for their non-observance of class distinctions. They board aircraft and fly club class to New York, and that scares the pants of the world. Right? So they affect the wrong kinds of people. And I'm not just talking about poor countries. How many people are aware that in August 2003, in October 2003, the government of France, one of the best-off countries in the world, the government of France acknowledged that in August 2003, 15,000 senior French citizens had died in a heat wave. Now, France has had heat waves before. Why did 15,000 people die in that heat wave? And why is it that all those 15,000 citizens were elderly pensioners and retirees? You know, the thing is, 879 people from SARS in 100 days, 15,000 people in rich France in the space of a month. And it didn't make the world headlines because they were largely poor elderly pensioners whose health benefits had been subjected to severe cuts in the preceding 2 or 3 years. That's why they died. If it had been 800 people of the flying classes, you got that kind of coverage. When 15,000, and again, we're not talking about Bangladesh or India, we're talking about France. 15,000 senior citizens died. It didn't make news. You can get onto the net and look at the figures and the discussion. They had a special parliamentary commission to go into it. I don't know what came of it. It might also be interesting to look at why China was the worst affected country by SARS. And that has a lot to do with what we're discussing today. In the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, we entered this world of structural adjustment, cuts in subsidies, cuts in basic services, withdrawal of entitlements of poor people, and privatization of just about everything, including soul and intellect. The Chinese government closed tens of thousands of factories. Now, if you're a citizen of China, you accessed your health through your workplace, through your school, your factory, or the local network that you were aligned with. When tens of thousands of factories were closed down across China, millions of workers lost their access to health. The chain of command, the alarm system, the signal system by which a new disease got reported and got checked at the labs in the tertiary level, that system completely collapsed. Therefore, when SARS hit, there was no plot on the Chinese government's part to conceal it. For most of the time, they really didn't know because they had destroyed the system by which they could have known. They destroyed it to save a few million dollars and lost a few billion dollars because the depredations you visit on the poor tend to come back to you. That was the year that the Chinese GDP took its worst hit in a decade and a half. Also, leaving severe scars on the GDP of Singapore, Thailand, and a number of other countries also hit by SARS. The great software festival of China was canceled. China lost billions of dollars, though it saved some millions, in throwing workers out of work, throwing workers out of their factories. So that happened with China. Did I mention France? In this country, I have no idea, I don't think there's a clear estimate, how many elderly Americans crossed the border into Mexico and Canada to buy drugs. Okay? I do know that your federal government has responded to it by conducting police raids on pharmacies in Michigan. Not by trying to provide cheaper drugs to poor people, but by conducting police raids on pharmacies in Michigan and on the Mexican border to prevent people from getting cheaper drugs. Okay, in Africa, thanks to the new institutional arrangements under TRIPS and the WTO, under the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights and the WTO, India, an Indian company which produced so far the cheapest, the company's name is Cipla, which produced the cheapest anti-AIDS drug, millions of Africans were denied the right to get this drug at dirt cheap prices by the intervention of multinational corporations of the pharmaceutical sector. After a huge outcry, after considerable outrage across the world, a compromise was reached, but the owner of the company will tell you that he can still provide it much cheaper if it were not for the pressures working on him nationally and internationally. In other words, the profits of corporations in this unequal world rate far above the lives of millions of Africans. That is absolutely clear. It's crystal clear from the conclusion about it. Yet, the game is unraveling. We'll get into some of the numbers of inequality a little later if you wish, but let's look at some surprising things that are happening. The guys running the game know it's unraveling. They're aware that things are not going as per plan. And maybe the plan was different in any case. But with one of the fundamental features of our time being the increasing and growing disconnect between mass media on the one hand and mass reality on the other, you don't often get to see these things highlighted. Let me quote three very, very important people and institutions. Our planet is not balanced. Too few control too much, and too many have too little to hope for. Too much turmoil, too many wars, too much suffering. Now, depending on who you are, that sounds either like Subcomandante Marcos of the Zapatistas or Mother Teresa. It's actually James Wolfensohn of the World Bank speaking. That's James Wolfensohn at the joint World Bank IMF meeting in Dubai. You know, nowadays the World Bank and the IMF are very careful to pick as venues places like Dubai, Riyadh, other places known for freedom of expression to hold their meetings in, so that all you protesters can go there and say what you like. Now, this is Wolfensohn speaking about concentration, inequality, too few own too much, too few control too much. Look at the language. It's very different from the gung-ho, trickle-down claptrap that you had for 15 years before that. 3 days after Wolfensohn spoke, this was towards the end of 2003, a small paragraph appeared in the International Herald Tribune about the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which, if you remember, during the Southeast Asian financial crisis, together with the United States government, Washington and others, nearly brought down the Malaysian government of Mohamed Mahathir for being recalcitrant and creating a crisis, blah, 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 blah. 3 days after Wolfensohn speaks, from the same meeting comes an acknowledgement from the IMF that the IMF has since accepted that Mahathir's capital and currency controls formula actually worked. You nearly brought down an elected government because it didn't conform to your prescriptions. And then calmly, 5 years later, you say, well, you know, our shucks, we got it slightly wrong. We just blew the whole region apart by doing so, but, you know, we're admitting it. Around the same time, the third member of the Trinity spoke. This is the Oracle, the Wall Street Journal. And we'll come to the Wall Street Journal in greater detail in a minute. A few days after Wolfensohn got it off his chest, the Wall Street Journal came up with this very original line. Well, original for the Wall Street Journal anyway. It wrote, the Wall Street Journal said editorially, yes, markets are a great way to organize economic activity, but markets need adult supervision. Gee, if they'd figured that out 20 years ago, millions of lives would have been spared. Now, I think there's a strong case that the World Bank, the IMF, and the Wall Street Journal are in urgent requirement of adult supervision. But, all three of them are now hedging on what's going wrong. They know that that market fundamentalism has run its course, that things are going very badly wrong. Throughout the 90s, to even suggest that the market was not God was to invite derision, attack, ridicule of a very abusive nature, right? The market wasn't just good for democracy. The market is democracy. You can't separate these two things. Now, as it begins to unravel, let me give you the later thoughts of the Wall Street Journal on the elections in India. This is the same newspaper that argued that markets are democracy, etc., etc. Here is the Wall Street Journal. It writes 5 days after the Indian election results, because that's how much time it took to get out of the trauma. Democracy is perverse. Democracy is perverse. It's attacking the Indian election results. Democracy is perverse. Although it is natural for the United States to suggest that all countries should embrace democracy, the lesson from India is that Western nations cannot be dogmatic about elections, except when they're in Iraq. The lesson from India is that Western nations cannot be dogmatic about elections. The journal continues, as India's elections will testify, this is on their op-ed or edit page, as India's elections will testify, Democracy is not always supportive of coherent economic policy and prosperity. You want me to translate that for you? It means that the voters are really dumb and very dangerous, and let's, you know, coddle them. Continue, verbatim quote. The West should be more hesitant about promoting political competition. For alas, that could destroy the leadership, unquote, that pursues real economic change. So don't promote elections and stuff. For God's sake, these miserable peasants in India go and change governments that are promoting markets. The WSJ continues. The lesson is that if India wants to be an economic power, it has to pay heed to the global voter known as the investor. If India wants to, you know, screw your electorate. You want to be a power, you pay attention to the global voter known as the investor. And then it adds as an afterthought, because it may not look all that democratic, in addition to your own voters at home. Gee, thanks. We can listen to our own people so long as they think the way you want them to. But surely that's a regression. But let me not put it all at the door of the Wall Street Journal. We have far more enthusiastic people at home, like the editors of our own newspapers, one of whom wrote when the collapse took place. In 2004, no government, just before the election, this editor wrote two pieces. In 2004, no government that the markets see as hostile can survive. Just before the election, he also wrote that the era of mass elections, mass meetings, door-to-door campaigning and election rallies is over. Elections will now be decided on the basis of what people learn from the media. As famous last words, those ranked alongside Tarzan's, who greased the grape wine? Yeah. He also made a pronouncement on after the crash, the markets have spoken. You know, he had read the entrails of the market, like the ancient wizards who read the entrails of the, you know, whatever animal that they made miserable. Now, all the other newspapers in the West contributed to the building of this tiger economy model, this emerging tiger stuff, when in fact inequality was being entrenched at a devastating pace. Let me give you the example of the New York Times. Mr. Keith Bradshaw, renowned investigative journalist of the New York Times and expert on the automobile industry, which of course qualifies him immediately to comment on Indian agriculture, is sent to the southern state of Andhra Pradesh to deify the greatest, the most beloved third world leader in the West, Mr. Chandrababu Naidu from my home state of Andhra Pradesh. If you Google this name tonight, if you check LexisNexis, you will find that no third world leader, the only other third world leader who has got an equal, who will get you an equal number of hits, is probably Saddam Hussein. Okay, but for totally different reasons. Naidu was the darling of the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, etc. Mr. Bradshaw, in analyzing, also joined the list of famous last words, said that Mr. Naidu's party is set to retain power. You know, this was before they suffered the biggest electoral defeat in the history of that state in decades. Mr. Naidu's party is set, that my home state of Andhra Pradesh, it speaks a language called Telugu. Some 70, 80 million people speak this language. And Mr. Bradshaw wisely commented, he studied the problem very closely. He visited the place for all of 6 hours or so and declared that Mr. Naidu's party seems set to regain power in the coming elections because he and his party speak Telugu. Now this is, you know, the rest of Andhra Pradesh speaks Esperanto, right? This is like saying that Tony Blair and the Labour Party are set to retain power because they speak English, which of course there might be a strong case for, because earlier it was Cockney, right? So anyway, all these predictions went awry, and you can see how angry they are with democracy when it works against them, because the poor there spoke and spoke decisively. Anyway, if you look at how... More on the free market. Has anyone seen the new patent laws and seed laws of Iraq? There's a free market for you. A completely imposed free market in perpetuity and in eternity captive to Halliburton and MCI and a number of other multinationals. Halliburton gets exclusive monopoly rights to import oil into a country with the second largest reserves of that commodity in the world at about 2.5 times the price of that commodity in that part of the world, exclusive rights of exclusive importation. A friend of mine calculated that it would be cheaper to drive the oil down by limo from Kuwait than to buy it at Halliburton's price. You should see these patent laws and seed laws. The people of Iraq didn't even know that they needed a seed law. It's been written by the Monsantos, the Cargills, and these guys. It's been, whatever other doubts you might have about the law, you can see that it's been written by the lawyers of American corporations. The language, the tone, everything is unmistakable. A country has been reduced to a colony in perpetuity. It doesn't matter how representative the government of Iraq is tomorrow. It can have no... The free market precludes Iraqi ownership of any Iraqi asset of significance. Okay? Soon after Saddam fell, a couple of very entrepreneurial young guys started a cell phone network, which was shut down physically by your army and handed over to MCI, which had no previous experience of building networks in such places. Right? That's the free market.
I'm sure the Iraqis will be very grateful. I see them expressing it every day. The
opening up process in many ways now, in many of these countries, resembles the opium wars of the 19th century. But let's look at this growth of inequality worldwide. Inequality has grown faster in the last 15 years than in the preceding 50. It's grown faster in the last 15 years than in the preceding 50. Every single report of the United Nations Development Programme's Human Development Report, which has been coming out since 1990-91, shows you this and shows you that it has intensified with every single successive year. The income gap between the top 20% of the world's population and the bottom fifth has more than doubled. By 1998, the top 20% consumed 86% of all goods and services. The bottom fifth of the world's population are currently living on 1.2% of the world's resources and services, goods and services. The world's richest 200 people doubled their net worth in 4 years leading to 1998, which means that they more than doubled their net worth in 4 years to over $1 trillion. And the assets of the top 3 billionaires are more than the combined gross national product of all least developed countries and their 600 million people put together. By 2004, the position had actually worsened. To that point is what I think the bank and the fund were beginning to worry about. That things are not going as planned, or maybe they were going as planned, but too well. Russia, look at the rest of the world. Russia, once the second superpower in the world, was subjected to shock therapy in the 90s and other doctrines of market fundamentalism. The former USSR lost 42% of her gross domestic product. No mean achievement, because no country has lost 42% of its GDP without either a war or a famine. Russia managed that with only the IMF and Jeffrey Sachs, without war or famine. Every year, if you check it out, 400 to 500 people die in the vicinity of Moscow of hypothermia, of cold, in the cold of Moscow in winter, while every year the number of Mercedes-Benzes sold in Moscow has soared. The sale of Mercedes-Benzes has gone up in every one of those years that more and more people have died of hypothermia. In fact, so many new boutiques and fashion boutiques and, you know, designer stores have opened in Moscow, that when Armani opened his designer store in Moscow, the International Herald Tribune mocked him gently, saying he was Giorgio come lately, because everyone else, Versace, Bulgari, all of them were already there, and all this time people were dying of hypothermia in the city. China, long one of the most egalitarian societies in the world, is now seeing gaps between its coastal areas and its rural interior that it has not seen perhaps in 100 years. The Chinese People's Procuratorate, a watchdog body of their Communist Party, a watchdog body of their Communist Party, the People's Procuratorate of China, towards the end of 2003, came out with a report saying that report on various things in which it mentioned that two of the giant and rapidly growing sectors of the economy are, one is corruption, the other is prostitution. That was the watchdog body of the Communist Party of China speaking. It forced them, in fact, to have a special session in their last Congress on this issue of inequality. It's in China, it's in India, it's in Russia. And by the way, just harking back to the... But all this doesn't gain ground because you have, as you see every night on every single one of your television channels, the giant soothsayer industry. It's getting better. Things are actually getting a lot better. You know, it's the baseline statistical... It's the baseline game. If you draw the baseline in the last ice age, everybody is doing better. And it's also the statistical averaging game, which we won't get into here. But just to give you an idea of the way of looking at growth, for instance, which do you think was the fastest growing economy in 2003 in the world? Afghanistan. Afghanistan was the fastest growing economy in the world at 21%. See, Afghanistan's GNP doubles if you just stop bombing. Okay, you build one school. It's a vast improvement. But by the conventional measures of growth, that was the fastest growing economy in 2003. And the United Nations, however, humbly added that 50% of that growth came from the cultivation and sale of opium. Because you've destroyed any other means of livelihood for poor people in that country. They just cannot earn another way. What about Africa? How did Africa do in all this? Ask Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist of the World Bank, sacked for his incompatibility or incompetence, which of course immediately qualified him for the Nobel Prize. As he points out, the African continent, subjected to forcibly imposed policies of the IMF and the World Bank, has lost nearly a fourth of her income. Even as African cotton farmers who grow the cheapest cotton in the world go bankrupt, American cotton producers, not farmers, because these are corporations, not farmers, get an annual subsidy of about $1 million each. No one can compete against that. So great is Africa's overall crisis today, and I think it's worth considering this point in view of all the amount of concern about outsourcing, that today, according to the Financial Times, the entire continent of Africa has just 20,000 engineers and scientists to serve a continent of 600 million people, because today there are more African scientists and doctors and engineers working in the United States than in all of Africa. Okay. And much of this drain of medical personnel has come from South Africa, the country facing the world's largest AIDS pandemic. So when we're talking about, you know, outsourcing, let's look at this reverse factor as well. Let's look at what's happening. Let's look at the millions of manufacturing jobs lost in China by the new process of liberalization, privatization, and globalization that's taken place. 200 jobs lost here, phenomenal outcry. And yes, what's being promoted, and that should be the way of viewing it, is a race to the bottom. Keep finding people who will work cheaper and cheaper and cheaper until you drive them into the ground. That's the game. It's a race to the bottom. It's not jobs stolen by one set of poor people from another set of poor people. In India, in the last few years, the inequality has... That's why I started with the theme weddings. The inequality has reached such proportions. Let me tell you some truths about the tiger economy. I speak very bravely these days because I have an election of 2004 behind me. Every time I spoke before that, my God, it used to infuriate people if I told them that this is what the government data shows. At a time when India was being promoted as the emerging tiger economy, its per capita food availability in 2003 was lower than it had been during the Bengal famine of 1942-43. You can check that figure in the pre-budget economic survey, a document that the government of India places in parliament at the time of the budget session of parliament. Amartya Sen's figures will show you that the per capita availability of food grain in the Bengal famine was 147.5 kilograms per Indian. In 2003, it was 141.7 kilograms per Indian, 7 kilograms less than it had been during the Bengal famine. In this period, we were still implementing the structural adjustment policies of export-led growth in a period when per capita availability of food grain was so low. India exported 13 million tons of food grain in 18 months at a price far lower than that at which she sells it to poor people in her own country. We exported that grain to overseas markets at 5 rupees 40 paise a kilogram, while selling it to poor people in Andhra Pradesh at 6 rupees 45 paise a kilogram. And then we boasted, look at our mountains of food grain. Mountains of food grain existed because the structural adjustment programs had so effectively destroyed the purchasing power of the poor that they could not buy food at those prices. It was that hunger that drove the kind of election results you saw last year. Once we entered the brave new world of liberalization and privatization, India cut development expenditure from her budgets, cut development expenditure from her plan outlays from 14.5% of gross domestic product to 5.9% of her gross domestic product. That is a cataclysmic fall from, that's a fall of about 30,000 crores, which is about $7 billion. We removed $7 billion from development expenditure. But we didn't just remove $7 billion. When $7 billion is invested in the Indian rural economy, it converts into about $30 to $35 billion of rural income. We blew that income away. And that's when the crisis began. That's when the farmers' suicides began. That's when our agrarian crisis took off. That's when thousands of farmers committed suicide between 1997 and 2003. Becoming the lead issue in at least two or three states in the election, the suicides of thousands of farmers, which I've had the misfortune, the total misfortune of being the mug who has to cover. Don't think that farmers' suicides are something that happen only in India. They happen right here in the United States. Maybe they don't all get reported as suicides because there are two problems associated with the reporting of suicides all over the world. One is stigma. The second in USA is insurance. So a lot of them, if you speak to the farm unions here, they will tell you that the number of suicides, which are not necessarily reported as suicides, but as accidents, because you don't want to deny the family insurance. In India, there are at least seven ways in which you can undermine the suicide figures, and that was the investigation I did between 2001 and 2004 in Andhra Pradesh, which I'm now doing in Kerala, and finding out that the number of suicides in the rich district of Wayanad, Kerala, is as intense as in the poor district of Anantapur in Andhra Pradesh. Because cartels have emerged at the global level, which are controlling and rigging commodity prices. Commodity prices have collapsed at the level of the producer, at the level of the wholesale, at the level of the small farmer. They haven't changed much at the global level. Each time one of you goes out there and buys a cup of coffee, 1/20th of what you pay for that cup of coffee goes to the guy who spends his life growing that coffee in Wayanad or in Brazil. The rest goes to Sara Lee, to Kraft, to Nestle's, to Starbucks, and to the big boys. Okay? That's how the world of commodities is now rigged. The prices of commodities are falling for the producer right in this country. In the United States between 94 and 99, consumer prices at the markets actually rose 2.8%. But family farm prices crashed 37.5% in this very country. We're just slaughtering the small farms, the small households across the world. If you look at your farm subsidies, which are leading to suicides in Africa, for instance, they didn't go to small farmers in the United States. They went to 26 Fortune 500 corporations. I was delighted to find who your struggling small farmers were when I checked the Associated Press database on this story. I cried buckets when I realized that, you know, poor old guys standing in the line for handouts of agricultural subsidies in the United States included Ted Turner and Scottie Pippen, and not to forget David Rockefeller. Yeah, they're all listed as recipients of agricultural subsidies in this country. Whereas your small farmer is going bust. I worked for a semester while teaching in the University of Iowa in the late 90s, in 1998, where every day I read in the paper about another family farm going belly up, more foreclosures, more farms closing. And once the farmers of Iowa had a spectacular protest where they came and released lots of hogs in the streets of one of the towns nearby and they explained that while the price of pork in the supermarket had not fallen 1 cent on the pound, their prices had collapsed. So somewhere, the money was going somewhere. Where was it going? This is happening in the United States. farmer suicides are occurring in the United Kingdom up to the 2001, for which figures are available, at 2.5 a week on average. Okay. They're occurring in Burkina Faso and Mali in Africa, where cotton growers of Burkina Faso are getting wiped out by the subsidies of the EU and the United States. All over the world, that small farmer is getting wiped out to the benefit of corporations. That's the kind of situation you're looking at. In Latin America, long the world's most unequal region, inequality rose so sharply in the 90s, which was terrible for a continent that had seen 100 million people fall already below the poverty line in the 1980s. They had two rounds of shock therapy.